Hi, and welcome to another CineStories podcast. I'm your host, Brian Dick. Today, I sit down with filmmaker Joe Forte to discuss his career and his new documentary, The Man Who Saved Ben-Hur. But before we get into our talk, a bit of business. Right now, CineStory is accepting submissions for our 2017 TV Digital Retreat. The next deadline is August 5th, but we'll be accepting submissions until December. To submit, or for more information, visit our website, www.cinestory.org. Joe Forte has been a longtime supporter and mentor of CineStory, so we were extremely excited to have him as our guest filmmaker at last year's feature retreat, where we screened The Man Who Saved Ben-Hur, a very personal documentary about his cousin, Johnny Alarimo. It's now being released on July 27th through Amazon, iTunes, and DVD. I met Joe in his home last week, where we sat down and discussed the origins to his writing career, his creative outlets, and of course, the man who saved Ben-Hur. Enjoy the podcast.
That ocean breeze.
Right.
So yeah, it was a bit of a shock when I looked down at my car temp.
Yeah.
When I was on the 101 and it was 97 already.
Yeah. It's been a really good summer, except for that, you know, other heat wave we had. But I mean, it's been surprisingly mild in the valley, so but yes, we don't get that. When the real estate market was great and people would go, oh, it's so hot in the valley, I would go, oh, you mean my real estate? But now I can't say that anymore.
Would you ever move out of the valley, though?
I probably don't think I would. I mean, other than the, you know, the months that are hot. Yeah. I think this neighborhood, and it's just luck that I live here, is one of the most central neighborhoods. I can get to Hollywood. I can get up the 405. I get to Beverly Hills. Right. You know, I mean, it's very centrally located, and I don't think it's... I go over to the west side, and I just... There's no comparison in terms of the congestion.
And downtown, right, where you're...
Yeah, I mean, I go downtown. It's, you know, 30 minutes, 20 minutes when there's no traffic, you know. So I just feel like... I have a lot of access here. Would I like to live by the ocean? Sure, but I don't.
How long have you been in L.A.? Because you're originally from the East Coast, right?
Yeah, I hate to say it. I came in 1991. So I've been here a long time. And now that I have children here,
yeah.
I mean, my children are California natives. That's right. Always crazy to say. So I'm a Californian, yeah. No, I love it here. We moved. Are we
yeah,
on? Are
on.
We talking?
Yeah.
Holy crap!
Like I said, I just hit record. And
we moved to Oakland for a year, because my wife worked on a movie at Pixar, and you know, everybody in the film industry or in life has a back door. You know, people are always like, "I'm going to move to Paris. I'm going to move to Wisconsin. I'm going to move to Vermont. I'm going to move to San Francisco," and it was kind of nice to get to experience like leaving.
Yeah.
And realizing how much I love this city and the people here. And one of the things we totally missed, and nothing against Oakland or up north, but everybody here is a striver. You know, everybody here is dreaming. And everybody is moving towards a goal. And that has a you know, a light side and a dark side. People are coming, people are going, people are winning, people are losing. But just that feeling in Los Angeles of striving is, you know, I think it's a great thing. I love it. I love that so many people I know are, you know, still evolving and trying to create their, you know, next page, their next chapter. So I love LA for that, for all its flaws.
Well, what brought you to LA? Because you could have stayed in New York and been a writer there and worked there.
I don't know if that's true, no. But the film industry, you know, yeah. I mean, I went to NYU and I worked in New York for, I mean, I went to NYU and got out and just started writing, and my parents had a cabin in the woods up in the Adirondack Mountains, and I would go up there in the winter and write, and then I would come home, and a friend had a tree industry, American Tree service, and I would, you know, help... you know, cut down sick trees and do the groundwork, and it was very hard grunt work. And then, you know, the fall would come around and I'd go, you know, back up to New York State for the winter and write. And then I, you know, another year I came home and I cleaned toilets. And I knew that wasn't going to be a long-term thing. And, you know, and writing was going to take a long time. So I started looking for a job. I pounded the pavement for a year and a half while I was writing and landed a job at an advertising agency in New York called Scally McCabe Sloves. And, you know, that was my first introduction to commerce and creativity. You know, as a creative person, I was a copywriter. I wanted to do the best creative work. And, you know, then you would come sort of into a collision with business, you know. And my first big lesson that I brought to the film industry was, you know, that the people who move forward were when they had their work rejected or edited, they didn't go and sulk and cry. They came back with something even better, you know. And so if a piece of work was turned down, I would just come back with something better and never give them anything that wasn't as good as I could do, you know. And that has an emotional toll, you know, but you just, you know.
How did working at the ad agency influence influence your script writing?
I guess just that you have to work with people, you know. I mean, I don't feel like this is so much a part of the culture anymore, but it was always like, you know, the creatives versus the suits.
Right.
And you can look at the suits as your enemies, or you can sort of be empathetic and try to understand what they have to do. You know, how they have to sell your work, what their challenges are, mm-hmm. and, you know, just helps you to navigate better and thread the needle, you know. So it was just, I feel like I always talk about commercialism as self-defense. Like, you have to understand the business to protect your work. And if you, you know, want to do work that you're proud of, you kind of have to, you have to shepherd it through the system. And that sort of helped me understand how to start to do that.
Which was what was the first thing that got you noticed where you started, you know, that you had to apply that to one of your projects?
Well, you know, as I'm telling you that, that's also a dangerous thing, because then you start thinking too much in terms of the business and not in terms of your voice. So part of the balancing act is also developing your voice and developing your point of view and taking risks and not trying to game the system. But at the same time, understanding there's a system. And so the first thing that got me noticed was actually... It was a script I wrote called Velvet Underground, and it was I haven't thought about this stuff in years. it wasn't a personal script, but I think it was very raw, and it was truthful about the main character, and it kind of had a genre template to it, but it wasn't a genre film. So I constructed it as a chase. So it had a kind of a commercial spine, but within that chase, I was able to explore these two characters in an honest way, and I think that was what got me noticed. It just felt different. And that's, you know, in the business, and the business has changed, and it's constantly changing. So when I got going in the early 90s, it was a different, you know, business. And the things that I wrote then, you know, I mean, it's just a different.
That was the time of the huge spec sales, right?
Well, it was spec sales, and you know, independent film was, you know, actually a viable economic model, and there were, you know, video sales and DVD sales, and there was a lot of money, so people were taking chances, and also it wasn't as global a business. Movies were made for the American market, and now they're not made for the American market. You know, TV streaming is made for the American market. So what was the independent film industry was has kind of become the TV industry now. So what I learned in advertising is, you know, it is a business. There are business realities, but then you also have to, you know, find your voice and find that balance for yourself, where you're talking about things or writing about characters that are real, that feel like, you know, there's jeopardy and risk in what you're talking about. As well as, you know, then there's a market for it.
When did you discover that you had this creative voice that you wanted to get into the arts?
As a kid, I drew and I made Super 8 movies, and I got a tape recorder for Christmas, and, you know, I didn't use it to be a journalist. I used it to make up characters and do little plays and little skits. And
do you remember any of them?
Yeah, I mean, my mother's side is German, so I did this whole routine about a guy getting tortured by the Germans. And I just remember I got this tape recorder for Christmas, and I went upstairs and just immediately did this whole routine where I did the voices, you know, the guy who was getting tortured and the German who was torturing him. And I came downstairs and I played it for my uncle. And, you know, he was wheezing. He was laughing so hard, you know. So it just, you know, made me happy.
Please tell me you saw those tapes somewhere.
I'm sure I do. I'm sure. Yeah. So, naturally part of what I did with my free time.
Right. So, I mean, from the beginning, for you, it was always film. You know, that you were interested in that media.
I mean, I have a kind of interesting story, or maybe not, which is my parents were, they don't like me to talk about this, but my parents were born-again Christians. They're very religious people, and I have a great relationship with my parents. But, you know, I grew up in a time where, you know, movies were taboo, and we didn't go to movies. All that. And I really grew up in a kind of strange vacuum where I didn't particularly understand, you know, there were not a lot of books in our house, and we had TV and stuff like that. And somewhere along the line, I discovered the Beatles, which was kind of like, oh, wow, you know, just that was art to me.
The early stuff or?
I was so backward that I had a friend who was in the Beatles and I was into the Monkees. You know, and I thought the Monkees came first and the Beatles stole everything from the Monkees. Right. You know, I mean, just like I was that kid and then started listening to the Beatles. And around high school, it sounds idiotic, but it just occurred to me that films were made by people. Like, I really didn't understand that. And I remember, you know, I would watch The Planet of the Apes on the 4:30 movie and just be transfixed. Or we'll get to talk to, you know, Ben-Hur, you know, and knowing that somebody, you know, in my family removed from me, but was part of that. And I had a really good friend who was an animator, and we made films, but it just never occurred to me as a career. And then he, senior year, got into NYU, and just like a light went off in my head, that's what I want to do. I want to tell stories and I want to make movies. And then I went to a Christian school in Pennsylvania called Messiah College. And after the first year, I transferred to NYU, and it was just a complete culture shock, you know, for me, because I had grown up in a very sort of sheltered way.
Right.
And I'm going to school with, you know, my classmates were in Nicole Hollow Center, and, you know, kids from, you know, cultured New York families who had this rich history in film, and they'd seen, you know, all these films, and I just was so far behind. But this is what I wanted to do, and there was a drive that just propelled me forward.
It also sounds like you didn't travel much either, you know, or with the family, like you basically.
Yeah,
your whole world was there with your family.
My world was my house and church and school.
Yeah,
and you know, that was it. And you know, I had a great family and a loving family life, but it was limited in terms of my curiosity and my hunger to sort of know the world, understand the world, and create. And, you know, I mean, the image I have in my head is, you know, I grew up 30 miles outside of New York, and there was always Manhattan, you know, and it was like, I got to get to Manhattan. You know, that's the place I need to get to, you know, and you make up stories and mythology about that place and fantasize about it. And
how did it fit the fantasy when you got there?
Well, I mean, look, New York's a mecca, and it's, you know, you're coming across such a variety of people and ideas and thought. So you know, I what was difficult for me was I wasn't in the conversation because I didn't understand, I didn't have a depth of knowledge. So, But I you know, just ate it up, and became a student of, you know, everything I could. So I mean, it fit the fantasy in terms of it was New York. It was exciting. It was glamorous. But it, you know, there's also a reality of it's hard, and you know, not everything in New York is the pinnacle. Right? I mean, it's a city, and people have their ideas, and some are right and some are, you know, maybe you don't agree with them. So, but it was a great place to interact with just a huge diversity of artists and students.
I mean, I ran into the same thing when I came out to SC. You know, I was born and raised in small town in Oklahoma that was 98% white.
Right.
And, you know, my parents, we traveled, you know, we went around, but it starts traveling like that is very superficial. You don't really get to know people.
Right.
And it is quite a bit of a culture shock.
Yeah. I mean, the first week I was going to leave NYU, I remember walking home and thinking, you know, I got to get out of here. I mean, my first film was, like, I had so little understanding of film language that my character entered the frame on the right and exited it on the left every frame. And I just remember my instructor looking at me like, wow, you're an idiot. Like, I mean, it was just, but then, like, I, you know, we had to make a film every week or every 2 weeks. And so we had to make a chase film or something. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, I'm going to go home and make a film. So I took a camera and I just made a film around my house. And, you know, it's always the thing, go back to what you know. I mean, place where I felt comfortable, place where kind of I could think through. But I made such a huge leap on my second film. You weren't supposed to applaud anybody's film in class. And my professor, like, just started applauding, you know. And I just appreciated that, but also sort of thought, oh, okay, I have an instinct for this. You know, I have a an ability, a knack. So, you know, it was encouraging. And when you're young, you need some sort of sense of encouragement and that there's a possibility and there's a route. So, and that's what was great about NYU was we were making films and you could flop on your face and you could also, you know, succeed.
Okay, so you were at the ad agency.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were successful at it? Did you like it? Because at what point was it that you then... did you leave the ad agency to come out to L.A.?
Yeah. Well, the great thing about leaving the suburbs and going to NYU and spending 4 years in that environment is, like, I felt like I could, you know, deal with or handle anybody. Right. So by the end of NYU, I had a level of kind of confidence from having to be exposed to so many ideas, so many films. And I think by the time I got to the advertising agency, you know, I had my feet on the ground. So I was really glad to be there. I was really glad to have a job that and I would go home at night and I would write. And I used my job to finance a short film. So, you know, that job was very much a stepping stone. And, you know, I love the people I worked with. I'm still in touch with them today. It was a great experience. I met my wife there, Meg, and we dated while we were there. And then she got an opportunity to move out to L.A. to work as an assistant at ICM. And I was finishing up my short film. And so she moved out and 9 months later I joined her. And also, you know, just at the same time, my best friend from high school, who we were, roommates, in New York, he went to LA. Everybody just started going to LA. So there was this kind of exodus. And it made coming to LA very easy for me because I had an instant community. You know, I had 6 or 7 friends from NYU. Meg was here. And what I did was I had those skills in advertising and I would, you know, I got this job where I would work 3 months over the summer writing the catalogs for Toyota and the cars. And it was incredibly, you know, just mechanical, not great advertising work. It wasn't creative at all. I mean, I tried to bring as much creativity to it, but it was a car, you know, catalog for, you know, the 1991 Corolla, you know. But it paid so well that I could work for 3 months, and if I lived really frugally, then write for, you know, 6 months. And so, you know, I just started writing a lot and, you know, I went through different kinds of script in terms of, you asked me about finding my voice. Mm-hmm. You know, you're finding my voice by writing things and... either sort of not getting, for me, the worst thing is in some sense to have no effect on somebody when they read it, that they don't connect to it in any way, you know? And so, you know, you're just things that people aren't connecting to or that are, you know, they're out of tune, you know, as you're learning to write and as you're learning to tell stories, you know, you write things that are like, okay, that works there, but it just doesn't, the whole thing doesn't work, or, you know, the character, or you're trying too hard, or this doesn't feel like you, or, you know, all those things where, you know, you do make the mistake of trying to, you know, write something commercial and please the marketplace. So in that process of going back and forth, I, you know, just started writing something that I thought nobody would ever buy, but, you know, I loved. And
was that Velvet Underground?
That was Velvet Underground. It was probably my fifth script and started to have command of the craft and started to have command of myself too. You know, again, it's that balance between, you know, you need, for instance, to understand structure because structure helps you communicate. It helps organize your thoughts. But within that structure is something real or personal compelling. And so the two came together in one piece, and people started responding in a consistent way. Readers started having a strong response, and that script then just, it's like you go from one person to the next, and you're like, hey, could you read this? Somebody reads it, gets excited. Is there anybody you can give it to? They give it to somebody, and it was the right script at the right time for me, and it's just started opening doors. It got me an agent, and it got reads all over town, and it landed me my first project, which was I sold a pitch to Egg Pictures, Young Egg Pictures at the time. So that, and Jodie Foster buys a pitch off you, you're in good shape. And that really launched me.
And what year was that?
94.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then during this whole time, because you're also an artist, so were you, and I know it was like 96, 97 that you studied under, was it Joe Ballstein?
Yeah. So, I would say I'm a serious hobbyist artist, and painting came out of the frustration of, you start working in Hollywood, and then you realize other people are in control of whether your work gets actually finished or not. Right. So you have, again, I came to this town incredibly naive, and lucky at the same time. I think to some degree my naivete, I move forward because I was naive, and but I was practical in other ways. You spend all this time writing something, and then it gets gets hard to move it forward. And so because I drew and was a visual artist and wanted to direct, I need an outlet for that. And a friend of mine invited me to a drawing class with a guy named Joe Blaustein. And I began that journey. I think it was in the late 90s. But part of what was great about, being a working writer was now I had money to reinvest in myself. And I think that's what I always did. I sold a spec script to Warner Brothers, and I had a choice to buy a new car or a baby grand piano. And I bought a baby grand piano because I thought, 50 years from now, that car will be in the landfill, but I'll have this piano. So I bought the piano, and I took jazz piano lessons, and I started painting. And, all these different ways of exploring what ultimately are of disciplines within filmmaking. So I play the piano and study jazz, not because I want to write a score, but because I enjoy, music, and it's therapeutic to me to sit down and play the piano. But in the process, I began to understand the language of musicians and music, and being able to think about music and talk about music. In terms of painting, it fed, it's color, it's texture, it's storytelling in its own way. And, that translates to cinematographers or production designers. I was always a, really serious amateur photographer. So one of the ways I always talk about finding your voice is one summer I bought 10 rolls of film. And I just decided to shoot 10 rolls of film and not print anything. Make contact sheets, but try not to go for a result. And by looking at the contact sheets and circling something that I felt a reaction to, I started to see in myself, in a very self-conscious way, what my voice was as a photographer, what I was naturally attached to or attracted to, and the themes that were coming out of the photographs.
Do you think there's a through line through all of that? That's one singular voice, or do you think it's almost different sides of you expressing themselves in different ways?
I think that it comes from a love of filmmaking, and so I love it so much that I want to be great at the process of it, and it both feeds me as a person. It's fulfilling to make something and have somebody respond to it, but it's also just this great inexpensive way to explore and develop a process. And so in painting, I've been able to develop a process that has translated into the way I made The Man Who Saved Ben-Hur. I work with collage, and so I love taking these disparate pieces of paper that have nothing to do with each other and sort of putting them together and arranging them away. And that creates an effect. That creates an emotional effect. And that's what editing is. Photography, it's framing and composition and understanding, like, wow, why is that photograph so compelling? You know, and another one's not.
Yeah.
And how something in a photograph can leap out at you. And also understanding that mistakes are awesome. You know, all the best pictures I've taken and the best pieces of art that I've made all have mistakes in them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about embracing mistakes. And it's about embracing and making them part of the piece. And I think films are so expensive that when you get to the moment where you're making the film, you can be very uptight and have to make it perfect. And you have to be able to relax in that moment. You know, you have all these people around you that are all looking at you. They're all talking in your ear. They're all asking you questions. And you have to be able to relax and stay present and in that flow state. So making music, making a painting, making a photography, it's for me about practicing being in that flow state. So that when I get to the place where I'm actually making a film and, you know, the deal is on, you're good at staying in that space. And you're recording that, you know. So however I am, if an actor is having a difficult time, if I'm getting uptight because we're running out of time, that's going to translate to the performance. But if I block out and say all I need is 2 seconds, literally 2 seconds or 10 seconds, to communicate something that the actor needs, then we can get, you know, what we need in the 4 minutes we have left,
right?
You know, because the sun's going down or whatever. So, and I guess, you know, going back to my upbringing, the sort of the fundamentalist framework that I grew up with was very rigid. It was all about rigidity, a black and white view of things. Don't. You are a sinner. You know, your instinctual ideas are sin. Like authentic impulses will lead you to death, damnation. You know, those were the messages. And when you're a young kid, you know, that becomes part of your nervous system. So all of these activities, I think, have been my way of teaching myself that I can sort of flow, and that those rules are not true. And that's, you know, it doesn't have to be black and white. And and to be present in the act of creation.
Hey, podcast listener. Sorry for the interruption. But I just wanted to give you fair warning that this is where Joe and I discuss The Man Who Saved Ben-Hur. So if you want to avoid spoilers, tune out now. Back to the podcast.
And so,
which I had to have come in handy when you decided to do The Man Who Saved Ben-Hur, because I feel like with documentaries, you have to be so fluid, not only with what you originally have in your head for what the piece is going to be, but when you're there in the moment shooting, of realizing, oh, I might be missing a moment. I need, you know, even though we're going to do this, you know, and deciding that, oh, we're going to throw that out and, you know, go shoot in the doctor's office or, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, what was I think the currency that makes the film work is that I was able to be intimate and present with Johnny. And Johnny was a very private guy. He was gay and, you know, kept that part of his life hidden from me and most of the people in the family, even though we were like, you're probably gay. He never let me in his apartment. He never let me into his world. Yet in public, like at Thanksgiving or if I would invite him over for Christmas, he was incredibly gregarious in terms of his stories. But there was a part of his, you know, it was a mask. Those stories were a mask. The stories about, you know, Bette Davis and Charlton Heston and Charlie Chaplin and Elizabeth Taylor and, you know, Heston and Wyler and all of them were a performance. And in order to, and for years I would say, you know, as a kind of way to get behind the performance, as a way to relate to him, as a way to connect to him, I would say, you know, why don't we make a film? Because after a while, when you've heard the same story told in the same exact way, written and directed, there's no way to interact with that person, right? I don't have a Douglas MacArthur story and even if I did, then you're just a name dropping. You know, you tell me about Bette Davis, I'm not going to tell you about Jodie Foster. You know, you tell me about Chuck Heston, I'm not going to tell you about Harrison Ford. Yeah. You know, it's just like, it's not a real thing. Like, I'd rather talk about, you know, hopes, dreams, struggles, you know, fears, wants, you know. And so, you know, making the film sort of was kind of a way of like, wow, you're a really curious, interesting psychology. And I really would like to get to know you. And the irony is the only way I'm going to get to know you is through making a film. And when I decided to make the film as a director, you know, you have to kind of make make choices in your approach. And I think the most important choice I made was that it's just going to be him and me. I'm going to shoot it, which now the photography came in. And,
That's a big decision to put yourself, decide that you're going to be on camera, you're going to be narrating, you know.
Well, one of the decisions I made, I'll just go back to this, was that I'm going to shoot this in 8 days because I don't know if he's going to die. Right. I don't know if he's going to get sick. And I don't know if he's going to kick me out. Because I'm going to be there to try and get to something truthful and something intimate. And my goal was intimacy. A friend of mine, Linda Goldstein, who's a documentary filmmaker, she said, you know, what's your question? And the first thing I said is, what's intimacy? And there was no intimacy with John. And he was entertaining and he was fun and he was riveting and he was charming, but there was no intimacy. So I went in with that approach. I forgot, was your second thing?
Well, I was just, because, I mean, as a writer, when you turn something in, you're giving a little piece of yourself to be judged. When you create a piece of art, you're creating something that's going to be judged.
Yeah.
But I just feel like putting yourself in the camera, like sort of really interjecting yourself in this.
Well, and I had no intention.
Whole other level.
I had no intention initially of putting myself in the film.
Yeah.
My approach to the film was, I'm going to do what I call the old man at the end of the bar template. It's like meeting an old man at the end of the bar and you're like, hey, you're a little old man. And then he suddenly tells you a story about Charlie Chaplin. And then he tells you another one about Bette Davis. And then he tells you one about MacArthur. And then he tells you one about Wilder. And you're like, who are you? You know? So I took that approach. And it was a very objective film, the first cut. And my...
Get that a lot here.
The World War II plane flying overhead. I took a very objective approach. And my idea was, you know, what can we know about people by the stories that they tell us? Even when they're trying to hide, what are they telling about ourselves? And it was an interesting intellectual idea, and the film worked, the first cut worked on a certain level, but it wasn't emotional. And what happened was Johnny died. You know, after the 8 days of shooting, what I was concerned about happened, which is he started to go downhill. And I think what you see in the film is I went from the guy who's caretaking his memories to the guy who's caretaking him. And our relationship truly got personal, you know, to the point where I was changing diapers, you know, of this man who wouldn't even let me in his home. And then I realized sort of,
How quickly was that?
It was 3 or 4 years. So the process of making the film was 4 years, and he died maybe 4 years after I started it. So I'm making the film and taking care of him. And he was in great shape the whole way mentally. He was very sharp all the way up to the end. But it wasn't until that after he died that I understood what the story was and the complete arc of the story, and that I was part of the story. And so that's when I became part of the story. But it was not my original intention to be part of it. It was, you know, he was going to be the subject, not, you know, me. And I think the film is an interesting kind of collaboration that I didn't expect between the two of us.
It was crazy to touch on his career and what he did. He was a second AD for a lot of the sword and sandal stuff that shot in Italy. And he talks about all, you know, he name drops a lot, but you know, there's not that many credits on IMDb, and that was one of the more fascinating things of movies back then, that not everybody got credits.
Yeah.
And it plays into the people behind the scenes and how many of them have these stories and relationships that are, you know, aren't told.
Yeah, I mean, Johnny was, you know, of the people behind the scenes, and many, many are fascinating. Johnny just had this incredible skill set. You know, he was an early student at NYU in the 40s, and he was an early student at UCLA, and he studied with Stella Adler, and he, you know, did summer theater in Princeton, and was on stage with Mae West, and then he applied for a Fulbright scholarship and won, and this is after coming back from World War II, and he ended up, you know, he went to Rome, and he landed right in the middle of the American film industry, a love affair with Rome and making films, and the first film he was on was Ben-Hur, as that was his first job, a second assistant director on a film that would, you know, win 12 Academy Awards or 11 Academy Awards. And, he was friends with Heston from Princeton. I mean, not best friends, but they were in a play together. You know, they knew each other. And he spoke Italian and he spoke English. And so you had this incredibly charming American who had studied with a great acting teacher who just really was one of them. You know, he was one of the stars, but he was just a regular guy. And I think there was something about the way he handled himself, how sort of soulful and thoughtful he was about acting in film, and that made him really in the center of the action. From there he worked for 20 years in Rome. And I think he just was, you know, if we share things, you know, him and me, he loved the process. He loved being part of it. And he wasn't really caught up in that era of credits. Even 30 years after his career ended, he wasn't resentful that he didn't grow. It's just the way it was, you know? And he would say sometimes, you know, oh, I thought, you know, I should have, you know, gotten some credit, and I did this and I did this and I did this. But it wasn't really his focus, you know?
With him from him being the guy that comes in and tells all these stories of his time in Italy and you know, hanging out with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, to getting very close with him, do you think it was his failing health, or was there a moment that just you got there? There was a moment that it kind of clicked in your relationship with him.
Yeah, I mean, I think our relationship was about trust, and I don't know. First of all, it took me years to get him to make a movie, so that the fact that he finally let me make a film was evidence of some amount of trust. And the way the process of trust was started, it was like a professional relationship. I mean, we were two filmmakers making a film. And one of my sort of happiest moments was we were filming and, you know, he turned to me and he said, "You're really good. You know, you're efficient, blah, blah, blah." And I thought, wow, I mean, this is a guy who worked with William Wyler. This is a guy who worked with Elizabeth Taylor and Rock Hudson. And
there are times he seems to be co-directing.
He wanted to. Yes,
this light's good, right?
Yeah. But I mean, so he started to trust me as a professional and as a filmmaker, and then that led to you know, him trusting me in a personal way, and he had to trust me. So I think Johnny led a very compartmentalized life. He found himself in his 80s with nobody. You know, he's that guy. What's powerful about his story is he had this incredibly glamorous life, and when I catch up with him, in a sense, he's, you know, a little old man in an apartment in Hollywood filled with boxes. And when I go into the apartment and start talking to him about these stories, which I assume are true, but you never really know, and then he starts unveiling the photographs, and then you're like, oh my God, it's all true. You were there, you know.
When that
relationship started to turn into a need, and I was happy and felt privileged to be somebody he could rely on. Because when your health starts to fail, and you know, your ability to sort of maintain your life goes, you're very, very vulnerable. And you know, I started to claim this person as a family member. I mean, he's my father's cousin, so he's my second cousin. We grew up at a distance. I mean, I didn't know him growing up. I mean, I met him once at a funeral. But, you know, the more I understood his story and his history, it was like, well, that's my story. It's a fragment of it. It's my history. And, you know, I just felt responsible for him. And I think in that process, real trust and you know, as intimate as Johnny could get, we created intimacy.
When did he open up about World War II and losing?
Well, what was amazing about him was I really expected there to be a wall, you know, and you know, a documentary is not a performance, but on some level he gave a magnificent performance. He gives an incredible performance in the documentary, and I know that's sounds contradictory, but I mean, this is the man who I was filming. So I had to film, you know, the person, and the person both performed, and that's what's fascinating. And also, in any great performance, there's truth under it. And he started on, it was like I was the priest, and it was his confessional, and he started to tell me the truth about and let down that mask and let down that and really start to, you know, unveil himself. But Johnny always spoke in code, you know, so
he almost had to at that time, right? I mean, being homosexual.
Well, just about anything. Like, he kind of spoke in code. And so my job sort of was like becoming the detective to sort of peel away the layers and decode him as a person.
Because we all want to know what happened with him and Rock Hudson and Capri, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, you know, I honored Johnny in the documentary in terms of I let him tell the story the way he wanted to tell it.
Right.
But you know, now that he's passed away, and I don't think there's any shame in it, he had an affair with Rock Hudson at the height of Rock Hudson's career, you know, and they went to Capri together and, you know, for a 4-day romance, and they, you know, had a romance in Rome while Rock was shooting A Farewell to Arms, and you know, it's
Drummond brings that up. I mean, he brings that up, that that's what convinces him to go on the trip, you know, is Rock Hudson says, when you're 80, are you gonna have this chance,
right?
You know? And you know, and he goes, I just got on the train.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when Johnny started to tell me that story, we never had discussed whether he was gay. We never discussed his sexuality. And I felt like, okay, this is the beginning of him. He wanted to talk about it. He wanted to, you know, I mean, if you spend a life, and this isn't just for gay people, it's all of us, you know, we do wear masks. There are things we keep hidden. And, you know, you get to a certain point and you're like, what the hell? And I don't think he kind of had the language to talk about it. But by making the documentary, he started to. And, you know, and it was my job to signal to him that it was okay. Like, I don't have a judgment that you're gay, you know. And then we talked about it. And he had an interesting view of his own sexuality. You know, I said to him, so, you know, are you gay, after the camera was off? And he goes, I'm on the fence. And I said, what do you mean you're on the fence? I said, have you ever slept with a woman? And he said, oh, no, I could never do that. So, you know, so I was trying to figure out his mindset. And I think from his point of view, if you were gay, you weren't masculine. You weren't a man. And he thought of himself as a man. He was very healthy that way. He was in charge, and he was, you know, he was self-directed. I mean, he was a confident person. He didn't live, you know, back in a lot of ways. So he had a healthy sense of self and psychology. And I just feel like he couldn't say he was gay because that meant he wasn't a man. So he found this space for him to exist, which was, I'm in the middle. You know, I just like, you know, that's just, you know, play around sex, or we fooled around, you know, versus I'm homosexual. Right. And I think that's just, you know, a function of the time he grew up in. And, you know, hopefully he lived long enough to realize that, you know, we were all okay with it, and it didn't affect our view of him as a person or his value.
And at one point in the documentary, he goes to a karaoke bar, and the song that he sings is "No,
You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You."
And to me, it was heartbreaking, because it almost felt very truthful. And that he hadn't really, he was unsure at that point in his life if he had actually ever loved anybody. And do you think he had, I know he had your love, but do you think he had the love that he was singing about in that song?
Well, this is what I meant by Johnny would speak in code. Like, all of a sudden he would break out in song, and the song he would sing to you was like in a musical, where it'd be like, oh my God, you're telling me something very important. And, you know, when we started filming, he announced that he was going to go to a karaoke bar and sing. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, I have a plot, you know. And we went to this karaoke bar, and I didn't know what he was going to sing. And he starts singing "You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You." And I'm like, holy shit, that's what the movie's about, you know. And yes and no, you know, in terms of whether he had the love he wanted. I think there was a part of him that was both completely fulfilled. He was a trailblazer in terms of his family. He went out into the world. He, you know, left home. He went to, worked in the industry he loved. I don't think he achieved what he wanted to, but he, you know, worked in the industry that he loved. He had amazing experiences, completely unique. And, but at the same time, I don't think he had the joy and grounding satisfaction of sharing your life with somebody. So I think there was an emptiness to his life. But in a way, it all works out in the end, you know, because I think the process of making the film was somewhat fulfilling. You know, I think he died with a smile on his face. And it could have been tragic. You know, I was terrified that he didn't have a will, that he didn't, you know, have his affairs in order, and that all his stuff would just end up on the curb or in probate or something, you know. And
now a lot of that stuff's been split up, right? You have some of it.
I have all of it that he gave to me, and I want to, you know, find the right place for it. I'm not really a hoarder like he was, so. You know, it's
the new museum. You could probably
get No, I mean, I'm looking for the right opportunity. As the film sort of gets a following and has a profile, I think, you know, that'll be the right time. But everything's been organized and cataloged, and it's a really interesting body of things. So, I think at the end of the day, his story is a bittersweet story. You know, and I feel like, you know, we got to connect at the end. He got to feel like somebody would remember him. And that became a fascinating aspect to me of the documentary, you know, that like he lives like a man. You know, he cataloged everything. He saved these photographs. And I would be like, but who for? You know, who are you saving this for? Who do you like, as if he was waiting to be discovered and, you know, that the Smithsonian was going to show up. And ironically, in a form, I did. You know, I showed up with a camera and cataloged his life. And I think that, you know, at least made him feel that he would be remembered. And that's an interesting part of being human, that we want to be remembered. We have this need to be remembered, even though we'll be gone.
Right.
You know, it doesn't make any sense that we want to be remembered. But I think if you drill down, it's just you had some impact on the world. You know, you were here, you had this incredible gift of life, and you did something with it. And I think that's part of the small little thread of the film where it gets to is talking about, you know, our need to be remembered and how many people do you need to be remembered by in order to have lived a satisfying life? Is one okay? Does it have to be millions? You know, and for me, I mean, and I think maybe this is something you would put at the beginning of this podcast if you're going to edit it. For me, what the film is about, it's a character portrait. But I think it's a character portrait of very interesting archetypal psychology, which is, I feel like the 20th century was the fame century. You know, I mean, you can name it a lot of things, but it's when fame became a possibility for anyone.
It's a commodity.
It became a commodity. It became an economic strategy. And I think Johnny wanted to be famous. He wanted to be known. He wanted to be an actor. And in that specific goal, he fell short. He didn't become a movie star. And that psychology became really fascinating to me. And, you know, what is important in life, you know, what, okay, so let's say you achieve that fame. What do you have? You know, it's going to fade. Kids today, they don't remember what Ben-Hur is. They don't hardly know who Betty Davis is. And if they know, they haven't seen her movies. So by being by interacting with them, I'm starting to have this view of like, holy crap, like all his favorite movies, all the things that he prized and loved and saw, nobody, you know, they're fading. And that means my, you know, favorite films and the stars I loved are going to fade. That means my work is going to fade. Like, so what are we living for? And the only thing he seemed not to have is connection, human connection. And that's the only thing you get, you know. And being somebody who's spent, has had a career in Hollywood and lived this life, you know, my joke is I'm going to get out of here with family,
yeah.
You know, because all of the rest of it fades. And I think that's what is kind of the essence of Johnny as a, as a, as an archetype of his time and our time, of somebody who constructed his life around the pursuit of fame. And to me, it's fine, but it's also a mirage, right? And we all intuitively know it's a mirage, but boy, it's hard not to, you know, chase after that mirage, right? And I think that's the part of the essence of this movie. I think that's the big sort of epiphany of watching this film. And I think it's hard for some people to watch this film because it calls into question, you know, your life, one's life. What are you living for? And the other thing I think is interesting is, for me, you know, people of a certain age are shut away from our culture. We don't see them. So, you know, it made me realize I only think of my life in terms of, you know, age 1 to 70 something. But, you know, Johnny lived to 89 years old. You know, your life is going to go all the way to your last breath. And it made me think about, you know, how I want to be in my last breath. You know, I'm going to live my life all the way to my last breath. And whether anybody's witnessing it or watching it, you know, whether I'm by myself because all my friends are dead and my kids are somewhere else or my, you know, whatever, I'm going to live my life to my last breath and try and have an impact to my last breath, versus thinking, oh yeah, some, you'll check out at 70 and, you know, the rest, who knows? You know, it just got me thinking about all those kind of things. And I think it's the movie is profound and scary because of that, because you have to think about your whole life in a way that maybe our culture doesn't necessarily talk about or promote.
Well, Joe, I know you have to get out of here, but thanks for sitting down and talk with me. I could sit here for another 2-3 hours and chat, but
me too, and thanks for this opportunity.